All right. I think I'm going to adjust this microphone up so I don't have to slouch as much. Thank you all for coming. This is, of course, a session on the new State Department's travel and advisory system. We're very blessed to have the Consul of Bermuda here, Marcy Brown. Marcy has the good fortune of getting to live here. So she has been here since the summer. She has been in shall we say, less sunny, beautiful, desirable places, or desirable in other ways. Prior to this, she's traveled quite a bit with her time with the Navy and, of course, with the State Department. So she's got some firsthand experience that I think she can relate to. She's also said her presentation of the system will last about 30 minutes or so. Then we'll have about 30 minutes for Q&A. And she has informed me that since this is the off season for them, she's got a little bit more time. So if you wanted to ask her a question offline, then feel free to stick around. She'll be around a little bit after the session as well. Okay, without further ado, Marcy Brown.
All right, so good afternoon, everybody. Fred, thanks for that introduction. I'm super happy to be here. So as Fred said, my name is Marcy. I've been here in Bermuda, lucky me, now in the beginning of my 3-year tour. And so today, we're gonna talk about our travel advisories, our alerts, and how you can use that information to make informed choices for you as a traveler or for your clients. But before we do that, I wanna talk a little bit about the role that consular officers play overseas, the support that we provide to American citizens. And okay, so we'll get into it. So essentially, you can think of the State Department as divided into two different missions. We have foreign affairs, which is your traditional diplomacy, bilateral relations between the United States and other countries, and then we have consular affairs. And in consular affairs, we're also divided in two. The first part of our mission involves visas. We issue non-immigrant and immigrant visas, so we help to secure our borders by facilitating legitimate travel of foreign nationals who want to come to the United States. Maybe it's just to visit, maybe it's to work or to study or to live if we're issuing immigrant visas. But the other part of our mission, and it's really the most important part of our mission, is the safety and security of US nationals abroad. In fact, when there are crises overseas, one of the first things we usually do is curtail or suspend our visa issuances so that we can focus on American citizens. So for example, here in Bermuda, we might be issuing visas in the morning and then doing American citizen services in the afternoon. A lot of our foreign counterparts, they separate consular services into citizen services or immigration or visa services, but in the United States, we do both simultaneously. So what we do, imagine, if you will, some sort of a tragic event, a serious illness or a really bad accident, or imagine if you were the victim of a crime or the victim of a sexual assault. And then imagine if that happened to you overseas, in a country where you don't speak the language, you don't know the culture or anybody there, and you're all by yourself. Every day, all over the world, consular officers provide assistance and comfort to US citizens when really bad things have happened to them. We work at over 260 embassies and consulates all over the world, and there is a consular officer on duty 24/7, 365 days a year in every consular district where we have a presence. But we don't just work overseas, we're also domestic in the United States. We have 25 passport agencies that are spread throughout the United States where consular officers work, and we also have consular officers serving in Washington. So our colleagues in Washington provide support and policy guidance for us overseas. So if we have a particularly complicated or confusing case involving an American citizen, we can go back to Washington where we have desk officers with regional responsibilities who can provide us advice on how to assist that American best. Okay, so on this slide, it has a little bit of an overview of what services we're able to provide for American citizens. And you'll see on the desks, there's a handout, this colorful paper here, which gives data and numbers on what it is that we do. The handout that you have includes visa numbers, but today I'm just going to talk about American citizen assistance because that's mostly what we focus on for this portion of the briefing. But we do emergency passports. That's probably our number one thing and probably the most popular or most common thing that your clients might have to deal with if they're traveling overseas. We issue about 50,000 emergency passports overseas every year. We can print them on site in our embassies and consulates. So unlike some other countries where it has to be DHL'd or FedExed in from overseas, we're able to do them right here on site. My record is 45 minutes from start to finish to print a passport. We can't always do that, but sometimes we're able to really, you know, if it's an emergency situation, we need to get someone out quickly, we're able to help. Medical emergencies, especially in countries where the standard of medical care isn't the best, we can provide American citizens with advice about where they can find medical assistance. We can help coordinate medical evacuations if necessary and provide basic translation services. If someone is alone by themselves in a country where they don't speak the language and maybe the medical team doesn't speak English, we can help bridge that communication gap. We can assist people when they're in hospital in contacting their family and friends back home if that's something they want us to do. For arrests and prison visits, we do approximately 10,000 prison visits a year. As you probably know, when Americans travel overseas, they are subject to the laws of the country that they're visiting. Sometimes they don't realize that, but it's true. So a lot of times when people are arrested, they expect us to be able to pay their bail and get them out of jail or demand their release with the host government or represent them in court. Those are things we can't do. But what we can do is provide them with a list of lawyers practicing in country that they can hire on their own to help represent them. We can help give them an overview of the legal system in that country and how their case is going to proceed through the courts. If they have any medical needs, we can help to make sure that those are addressed to whatever extent is possible. And again, if it is their wish, we can help provide contact between the prisoner and family and friends back in the United States. We also do about 30,000 welfare and whereabouts visits or calls per year around the world. So an example of that, a lot of times with younger travelers, they might be off trekking somewhere and they haven't been in contact with their parents in a while. So their parents will contact us, frantic, because they haven't talked to their son, and they will call us and say, can you find them? Now, sometimes it's difficult. It's sort of like finding a needle in a haystack. You know, if you're in Morocco and someone calls and says, my son is hiking in Morocco and I don't know where he is, well, you know, what can we really do with that? But it's our job to build strong relationships with host country law enforcement, medical services, hospitals, and clinics, so that if they encounter an American citizen who's in trouble, they'll call us right away. And in many places around the world, that's exactly what happens. You know, host country law enforcement or medical staff, they don't want to see anyone, any tourist getting into trouble. So if they encounter them, they're usually really good about calling the embassy or the consulate. I'll give you an example of a welfare and whereabouts call that we got. I was serving in a country. A frantic mother called and said that her son had posted something on Facebook indicating that he was intending to kill himself. And that's a really difficult one because all she knew was that her son was somewhere in the country, probably in the capital city. He had a history of mental illness, and she was very worried that he might do himself harm. So we asked, please, you know, think really hard of where he might be. She didn't have a phone number for him. He wasn't answering his email, and she didn't know where he was living. But she said, I think he said something about working at a newspaper. So then we asked him, well, does he speak the local language at all? And she said, no. Well, right away we knew that if you're in this country and you're working for a newspaper and you don't speak the local language, there's only one newspaper that's gonna hire you. And as luck would have it, we knew the editor of that newspaper because we had recently worked with them to post some advertisement for American citizens to get them to register to vote. So we were able to call the editor, say, hey, this is kind of a long shot, but do you know who this guy is? And he goes, oh, yeah, I know him. I just fired him today. So we said, do you know where he lives? Is there any chance you could send someone out to his house? So they did, and they found him, and it turns out he had just taken a large number of pills. So they were able to rush him to the hospital, get him the care he needed, and he was okay, and his mom came out to bring him back. So that's an example of a welfare and whereabouts where, you know, we could have just said, hey, sorry, we can't help you, but we were able to do some digging to help this mom figure out where his son was, and it ended up with a good ending, thankfully. We are also one of the few countries around that still does financial assistance and repatriation for our citizens. So in the rare case that an American citizen overseas is truly destitute, has absolutely no money left, and needs to get back home, we would rather provide them with a loan in the form of a one-way ticket back to the United States than have them homeless living on the streets in a foreign country. So when that happens, we are able to get them a ticket back to the United States paid for by the US government, but it comes with their passport being annotated, so it's only valid for a direct return. So they won't be able to do any more international travel until they pay back that loan. So that's another service that we provide. We do only about 1,000 of them a year worldwide. But believe me, when you have someone in your consular district who's destitute and has absolutely no money, you really want to get them back to the US as quickly as possible. So another important service we do is with regards to deaths in estates. Approximately 10,000 Americans die overseas every year. When an American dies overseas, again, the local hospitals and police are usually really good about informing us when they become aware of an American citizen death, and they're able to help us inform the next of kin or locate the next of kin if needed. Sometimes the next of kin is traveling with the individual, and that's not needed, but we are able to produce a consular report of death abroad, which is based off of the local death certificate, and it carries the same weight as a U.S. death certificate. So if you were to die in, for example, Mauritania, which is the last country that I was assigned to, you know, the death certificate, it kind of comes on a piece of, like, tissue paper. It's written all in Arabic. Trying to settle someone's affairs using that is going to be pretty challenging. But we can take that document and produce a consular report of death, which will allow the next of kin to close their bank accounts and settle all of their affairs. So that's another service we provide related to death. We can also help the next of kin coordinate repatriation of remains, working with local funeral homes, if there are any. In some countries, there aren't any local funeral homes. But normally, we can coordinate with the funeral home back in the US to make that run smoothly to assist the next of kin. So that's an overview. I'm not going to go over all of the things we do because a lot of these are routine services. There are approximately 8 million American citizens who live overseas permanently. So a lot of the routine, like notarial services, registering to vote, citizenship documentation in the form of if you're an American citizen and you have a baby overseas, we will provide a consular report of birth to document that child is an American citizen. Those are more things that are geared towards Americans who live permanently overseas. But that's just a general overview, the things on the left, of things that we do for American travelers. And the very last one I should mention, actually, crisis response. When American citizens happen to be overseas, when something happens, whether it be civil unrest, natural disaster, or things of that nature, we're able to provide assistance, and in rare occasions, evacuation. But we always ask that when Americans plan their travel, they have a plan in place that if something went wrong, they would be able to get themselves out without the U.S. government's assistance. Okay, so we are more than happy to provide assistance to American citizens when they travel overseas. But we hope that we never have to do that. So here are four things that we ask American citizens to do before they travel. And the first one is to get informed. This is hopefully something that people do on a regular basis. They can consult our website, travel.state.gov. And I'll be talking about that over and over and over again, because travel.state.gov is our one-stop shop for all information travel related. That's where our travel advisories are. That's where our alerts are, and that's where anything related to entry and exit requirements, all those sorts of things are found on that one website. So we always want people to do their homework before they travel, obviously. When I was in Mauritania, I was surprised at how many people would think that they could just rent a car from Senegal and drive to Morocco, and they would make it through the Sahara Desert with a rented Kia, and that was okay. You know, when I was there, we couldn't leave the city without special permission. And even then, it was in a vehicle convoy with four-wheel drive and GPS tracking. I mean, it was pretty tightly controlled. So we always want people to do their homework before they travel. Some countries have restrictions on passport validity. So let's say you're planning a travel in you're planning a trip in March, and you only plan to be away for a week, and your passport expires in June. A lot of people might think that's perfectly fine, but some countries have special restrictions on how long your passport is valid. They might require it to be valid for 6 months or longer in order to enter the country. So we always want people to read up on that stuff before they make their plans. The next thing, get required documents. That again, with regards to the passport, I had mentioned earlier that we have 26 passport agencies spread throughout the United States. If you have a client who suddenly realizes that their passport has either expired or is going to expire and it will impact their travel, most of these passport agencies are within a day's drive to a lot of urban areas. So you can go on our website, travel.state.gov, find out where the nearest passport agency is for that person. They can make an appointment, and they can get a passport issued expeditiously to save them from having to cancel their travel if they're in that sort of situation. Some countries have restrictions on people who hold dual nationality regarding military conscription and all sorts of interesting things. So that's why we want to make sure people do their homework before, so they don't get any surprises. Same thing with prescription medications, all that kind of thing. Something that is second nature to us, we don't think twice about it. Entering a foreign country, you might find that the rules are very different. The next thing is STEP, our Smart Traveler Enrollment Program. We encourage everyone to enroll in STEP. And if you are planning a trip that involves a group of people, you can actually set up a group account on STEP, and you can upload a spreadsheet of people so that your individual clients don't have to go registering in STEP. You can register for them as a group of people. I swear by STEP because the world has become a lot more dangerous than it was, say, 10 years ago. You know, the train station bombing in Brussels, terrorist attacks in the UK and France, these were all places that for a really long time were considered safe destinations. And so the benefit of registering in STEP is that if you are on your trip and some sort of emergency happens and we push out a travel alert, which we're going to see in some of the upcoming slides, that will automatically be pushed out to your phone. So, you know, when I was in Mauritania, that was when some of these terrorist shootings happened across West Africa. We would see these alerts come out and say, active shooter at Hotel X, stay away from the area. So it's not really an exaggeration to say that that sort of information, for you to be able to have that, could be the difference between life and death. So I really can't stress it enough. Enroll in STEP. We do not sell email addresses. We don't spam people. The only thing we're going to use that email for is to push out security or safety information to American citizens. So it really is a good program. And the last one is get insured. It's really heartbreaking to see people who don't have adequate travel insurance, and then they have some sort of catastrophic medical event, and they require a medical evacuation, but they can't because they can't afford it. Because as I'm sure you know, the costs are staggering. So we always encourage American citizens to have proper insurance before they travel. Okay, so our new travel.state.gov went live in December of 2017. We undertook a year-long assessment of our safety and security information, and we basically found three areas for improvement. We realized that the public didn't always understand the differences between the old types of messaging that we had. So we had country-specific information, we had travel warnings, we have security messages, emergency messages, and nobody really knew the difference between them. They were confusing, and a lot of times the actual actionable message in there was sort of buried in a lot of boilerplate language that wasn't really helpful for people. And lastly, we also realized that our internal clearance process was slowing down our ability to get out that information in a timely fashion. So we did a lot of consulting, a lot of looking, and how can we make this information more useful to the public? And the other thing that we really wanted to do was to make it up to date and viewable and easily viewable on smartphones and tablets, because for a lot of people, that is their primary mode of communication now. People are getting away from desktop computers, and our old systems were really optimal on desktop computers, but that wasn't what the public was using anymore. So travel.state.gov is now our place where all of our new travel advisories are, and I will show you those. So basically what we did was, instead of just having travel warnings for countries that we had concerns about, we did a travel advisory for every country or area of the world. And then we divided up those countries into one of four levels. So level one is exercise normal precautions. Level two is increased caution. Three is reconsider travel. And four is do not travel. So the lower the number, the better. And then what we did is we put these travel advisories on our travel.state.gov. This example, if you can see it, I know it's a little hard to see, but this is for Canada, which is a level one country, of course. And does that mean you can't get mugged in Canada? Well, no, but generally speaking, Canada is a very safe place. So all it says there in the text, it's hard to read, but it's below the Canadian flag. It says exercise normal precautions in Canada. And then the other things that we have on there is towards the bottom right, it's cut off, but it's all of the contact informations for the embassies and consulates that we have in Canada. And there's quick facts about entry and exit requirements, any special things you need to know. And then any alerts that we've put out related to Canada recently will also go up on that page. So that is an example of a country with level one, what we've called level one. This is an example of a country that's level two. It's Tanzania. And so any country that is not a level one, we're telling you exactly why we have given it the level that we have. And that's not canned language. That's language that we've specifically written for that country. So Tanzania is a level two country, and we say exercise increased caution in Tanzania due to crime, terrorism, and targeting of LGBTI persons. And then we give further details beneath that. And then we'll say, if you decide to travel, here are some things you can do to keep yourself safe. Now, just because a country is in exercise increased caution, that we're not saying don't go there. We're just saying go, but be aware of these particular things that are going on that might make your travel more difficult. So it's just advice to make people more aware of the local conditions. And then the same thing for that. We have the listing for the embassy and any consulates that are located there, and any entry or exit requirements for that country as well. Okay, now we realize that not all countries can be categorized uniformly. So Jamaica, for example, is an example of a country that we've classified as level two, but there are some areas of Jamaica that we're saying are level four, meaning do not travel. So we're saying for Jamaica, we want you to exercise increased caution in Jamaica due to crime. And then we're advising that you do not travel to some areas of Kingston because of crime, some areas of Montego Bay, and Spanish Town. And these are all because of crime. So if we're saying a country is level two, but there are some areas there that we want you to exercise more caution, we're going to tell you exactly what those areas are. And then again, we're going to say, if you do decide to travel, here are some precautions you can take to make sure you're safe. Okay, so here's an example of a country that's level three. Level three is reconsider travel. So Niger, we've said reconsider travel to Niger due to crime and terrorism. And then the same thing, we go into detail about why we have decided to say that we want people to reconsider travel. And then if you do decide to travel, here are the precautions you can take. So it's basically the same thing. And lastly, Syria is an example of a country that is level four, do not travel. So with a country like Syria, we're saying exactly why we don't want you to travel there. That, again, that's our advice. We can't stop you from traveling, but our advice is not to travel there. And then for the countries that are level four, we're really upfront about our advice. So we basically say, you might want to make funeral plans or fill out a will. It says it right there. We're trying to be really blunt with people so that they're aware of the level of danger we're talking about. And there are very few countries around the world that we've categorized as level four. No one wants to read that, but sometimes, I think that's what it takes to sort of make people realize the danger involved. So those are our four levels, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And again, whereas previously we only had travel warnings for some countries, we now have a travel advisory for every country or area. So Bermuda's not a country, but it's an area where people travel to. So Bermuda has a travel advisory. Antarctica has a travel advisory. So we've made travel advisories for all of these locations. Again, you can find them all at travel.state.gov, right under travel advisories. Some common questions that people ask is, can I see a list of all the level one countries, all the level two? The map is probably the best place to look. So if you go on travel.state.gov, we have an interactive map, and it's color-coded. So those countries that are in red, those are the level four do not travel countries. The countries that are that orangish color are the reconsider travel. The yellow countries are exercised increased caution. And the countries that look like they don't have any color at all, those are the normal precautions. Now, when you see the hash marks or the stripes, those are the countries that have one level, but then there are other areas of the country where we have an increased level. So does that make sense? So also on this map, and by the way, this map, when this went live, we had millions and millions and millions of hits on it because people like that sort of interactive visual kind of site. So you can hover the cursor over the stars and the various symbols for the consulates or the embassies, and it will pop up with the contact information for that place. And if you click on it, it will go directly to the information for that country. So a lot of times people ask, well, can I see a list of which countries are which categories? The best way to do it, honestly, right now, is to go to this map, and you can have a visual representation. Okay, so the alerts are now replacing our security and emergency messages. And we wanted the alerts to be very, very clear. We wanted someone to be able to get an alert on their phone and not have to scroll through a whole bunch of text to understand what it's saying. So there's an example here. It's called a health alert for Barbados. Location is south coast of Barbados. Event, there's an overflow of raw sewage. Actions to take, avoid the water. So it's really clear of what's happened and what we want you to do. So people are able to understand very quickly what the purpose of the alert is. And again, the alerts can be for health reasons, security, natural disaster, civil unrest, terrorism, any sort of event that's going on that's emergent in nature or short term, we'll send out an alert for. Okay, so our resources, you can go to travel.state.gov and see a listing of all embassies and consulates around the world to find out where you can best get assistance. If you have, if you're interested, if you're on Facebook and Twitter, you can like U.S. Department of State Consular Affairs. We post a lot of the alerts and changes to alerts on our Consular Affairs Facebook page. So that's also a really good source. Or if you're traveling or you're planning travel to a country, like their Facebook page, because we have hundreds and hundreds of different social media accounts in Consular Affairs. We have a combined follower base of about 82 million people. So we're really trying to get savvy on social media because we know that's how so many people nowadays get their information. During the most recent hurricanes that came through the Caribbean last fall, our messaging was able to reach 14 million people. So it's a really good way to get the word out. So if you're planning on traveling somewhere or you're planning a trip for someone, like their Facebook page. You can always unlike it later if you don't like the content it's putting out, but it might be a really good way to get some information. On there also is our Overseas Citizen Services number. So a lot of times when bad things happen to American citizens, the first call they make is not to the embassy or consulate overseas, it'll be to their family back in the States because they don't know what else to do. And a lot of times the family will then call us in Washington. And our duty officer in Washington, that's the 888-407-4747 number, can then get in touch with the duty officer in whatever country where that person is to put us in touch with the individual who needs assistance. So that's also a good number to know. And then I'll put in a little plug for OSAC. OSAC is the Overseas Security Advisory Council. It's security cooperation between U.S. private sector interests and the U.S. Department of State. There are over 3,500 U.S. companies, educational institutions that are OSAC constituents. So if you don't already know about OSAC, check out their website. It's osac.gov, and you can find out more about that. Okay. What questions do you have?
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much. And just for those of you who are not familiar with the STEP program, I just want to say it is a fabulous program. We register all our travelers, and you literally get the alert on your cell phone. So you can respond within minutes to any, you know, new change of information. So thank you, that's great. My question, you probably saw it coming, is to what extent are the advisories politically motivated? And I ask that question because I look at countries like France that is a number two, mm-hmm. and then I compare that with a country like Cuba or Russia, which are number three, or Iran that's number four.
Right. We totally understand that sometimes our travel advisories will ruffle the feathers of our host government. But that is not a factor in the levels that we assign or the decisions we make to put out information. Our sole priority is the safety of U.S. citizens. So if that is something that our host government is not happy with, that doesn't factor into the decision we make, nor do we consult them when we are putting out information to our citizens.
But why do you consider Russia to be more dangerous, given historically what's happened in the last 24 months, why do you consider Russia to be more dangerous than France?
I mean, I can't get into specifics about why decisions are made for each individual country, but don't compare. I mean, it's not meant to be a comparison, and there really is no equation like, if this, then it must be level this. If this, then it must be level that. One thing that we do take into account when we do the levels is the degree to which our own missions are staffed in a country. So if one of our missions goes on authorized or ordered departure, that will cause us to really take a look at what level or what type of advice that we're gonna give American citizens. Because one thing we have to consider is, to what extent are we able to provide assistance to our citizens in the event of an emergency? So, for example, when I was in Mauritania, we were unable to leave the capital city without specialized permission. So if there was an American in some far-flung area of the country, we wouldn't be able to get to them. So it's hard for us to recommend people to come to a country when we're not able to provide them with support.
But can you make that clear? Because I don't think people necessarily understand that. And so for somebody who's really, you know, wanting to make sure that they're not going to a country where they're going to be unsafe, like Cuba, I mean, I understand that the reason it went to a number three is because you reduced the embassy staff, but that is not on the advisory.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point.
Is there any prerequisite? This is Barbara Kakalidis from Rosewood Hotels. Is there any prerequisite for these institutions, like the colleges and universities, to have some type of relationship with you when they do these overseas programs in like exchange students and things like that?
No, not at all. I mean, we hope that people will register in STEP, but aside from that, no. I mean, there's no requirement to check in with us. There's no requirement to brief us beforehand on what you're doing. It's just get informed, read up about the country you're going to, and then please, please get insured and registered in STEP.
Thank you.
Okay.
Any other questions? Come on, you're thinking questions.
So when the level changes for a destination, is it noted kind of when it was last updated, or how is it highlighted that one went from a 2 to a 3 or
That's a good question. I know that they are reviewed. They're going to be officially, because this just came out on the 10th of January. So they are formally going to be reviewed for the level 1 and level 2 countries every year, and for level 3 and level 4 every 6 months. But it's really important to note that if the circumstances in country change, to the extent that we are going to change the level, we're not just going to wait until 6 or 12 months. You know, we will do it right away if circumstances change enough. And when it's changed on the travel advisory, I know with our former travel warnings, there was always a date right on them. But that's a really good question, because it just went live on the 10th of January. I don't think we've changed any travel advisories yet from what we started out with. But I would imagine that when one changes, it's going to have the effective date on it, just like our former travel warnings or messages had.
Thank you.
Sure.
So under the old system, if there was a problem, and I'll take Kenya, because Kenya has been under travel warning for a long time. Mm-hmm. If there was a problem in Nairobi, the whole country got black marked and became don't travel to Kenya. Mm-hmm. So what happens in these kind of situations now where there is a problem in Nairobi? Are you going to downgrade it? Does it now become a 3 and the whole country becomes a 3? How do you determine when the level actually changes?
Well, it's an like I said before, there's no real specific formula if this. We consult with our interagency, we consult with our local embassies and consulates, we consult with a number of different sources to determine if the level needs to change. Now, I used the example of Jamaica, where Jamaica was overall a level 2, but there were some areas that were level 4. We won't ever have it be the opposite. So in other words, we won't have a country overall be reconsider travel to this country. Oh, but there are some areas where you can exercise normal precautions. Does that make sense? So it's always going to be, exercise increased caution, but don't go to this area. So you could say, you know, Kenya in general is this level, but then we have these specific areas where we need you to watch out.
So it's a more just system.
I'm sorry?
It's a more just system now.
Honestly, I think it is, because the travel warning really did cover the entire country. So there may be some areas of a country that are fairly safe, but we've issued the travel warning to cover the country in its entirety. Whereas with the travel advisories, we can distinguish, you know, those are the countries that have the stripes on them. So we can distinguish between a country that overall it has this level, but then in some areas it's a little more dangerous, so we want you to be careful.
you consider the travel warnings according to the American citizen or the tourist that is there or the local people?
And American citizens.
Okay, what is dangerous to the American citizen?
Yes. And we totally realize that the dangers that may exist for U.S. citizens may not
the same.
Be as present for locals. That's completely the point. When I was in Mauritania, it was very dangerous for someone like me to walk down the street. The people that were being targeted for violent crime were not the locals as much as it was the Westerners or people who were perceived to be a Westerner.
Sometimes it's the opposite.
Sometimes
in Mexico,
it is, yeah.
I'm talking about Mexico, it's the opposite, really.
Yeah.
Where it's the local people that, you know, the drug cartel and the tourist really is not involved.
Right.
First, okay. How does the alert system work? So like, while I'm traveling, I sign up with STEP and I get the warnings pushed to me. But if I want to find out about an alert, it's always up to me to look it up. Or is there a way that one gets them pushed or can register? Or
as of right now, the only way to get the alerts is if you are registered in STEP. Mm-hmm. Now, like I mentioned, if you actually like the Consular Affairs, the U.S. Department of State Consular Affairs Facebook page. Those alerts are routinely posted on the Facebook page. Now, that's not to say that 100% of alerts are always going to go on their Facebook page, but just from what I've seen in the 3 weeks or so that we've gone to the alert program, I see it on my Facebook feed popping up saying there's alert in this country, there's an alert in that country. Another way to do it, and this is a little more labor intensive on your part, but you can go to the map and actually click through the travel advisories to see if there are recent alerts for a country.
Mm-hmm.
So other than making a trip in STEP that you're not really taking,
yeah.
And we don't want to encourage people to do that, because of course if there is an emergency, we're gonna be looking for you if you've registered in STEP. So the best way to do it, I would say, until we have another program that allows people to sign up to receive the alerts, even if they're not in STEP, my best recommendation to you is just to like us on Facebook, because most of them are being posted on Facebook.
And it's the travel.state.gov?
Travel.state.gov is our website. Uh-huh. And then actually at the bottom of that blue paper you have, I believe it has our Facebook and our Twitter. So our Facebook is travel.gov, but you can also find it by typing in U.S. Department of State Consular Affairs. Because the main State Department has a Facebook presence, but this is U.S. Department of State Consular Affairs. We have our own Facebook page where we put that out.
Okay, thank you.
Getting back to Cuba, I'm sorry. So, there are two main reasons why Cuba's a three right now, the health attacks against the consular people, and then the reduced staff, right, at the consul?
Well, I can't speak directly to why. I wouldn't say there are two main reasons.
Well,
I mean there were a number of reasons. But
those are pretty highlighted. And so if 6 months, a year goes by, would they eliminate one of those reasons but keep it a three because of reduced staff? I mean, are you likely to be able to understand what that three really means after time?
I would say that the best advice I have for you for that is for the threes, it's the text right below, you know, where it says reconsider travel, the Niger example, for example. That text right below it is going to tell you why.
After 6 months when you've reviewed it again.
Or I would say, If something changes, we won't wait for the 6 months. I mean, we are required to review them every 6 months or 1 year. But if things change enough that we have that the circumstances are different, we'll make an edit to it.
That kind of answers my question. I was going to ask you, what is the frequency in which the State Department is reaching out to these external resources, mm-hmm. like the consulates, to review this information if things are happening so quickly?
We keep in pretty frequent contact with our desk officers back in Washington, and so we don't want this information to go stale at all. So if things change enough I mean, they're keeping on top of it, but we're keeping on top of it too. I can tell you, I exchange emails with my desk officer very frequently for American Citizen Services. So if something is going on, we're, like I said, we're not going to wait 6 months. It will get changed on a regular basis.
Here's a question. You can take a deep breath for a moment. Let me turn now to ask our good friend from the insurance industry, if this Susan Weiss, if you will, if this new rating scale could have implications for insurance rates, either at amount or even issuance of premium. Here, I'll be the mic person.
That's a very good question. I don't believe that the insurance rates are determined by the destinations and the levels. We just determine the rates through our carriers, typically just based on the ages and the trip cost. We don't base our rates at all on destination. Right.
Sure.
This is another question for the group, not necessarily for the speaker. How many of you in your institutions have different policies that prohibit group travel if there is a 3 or 4 warning? Does anybody know if they have a prohibit against that? Okay. How about if it's just a level 2? Can you still go? Okay. So that's, now the question is, of course, to all of you, something can happen in a place. We've got everybody. We've got travelers going. We've got everything. Something can happen in a minute, and then suddenly it's a 3 or a 4, and we've got people going. At what point do you make the decision not to go is another question, I think, you know, and the change of that.
I think related to that, I just wanted to clarify, you said you would never have a country that's rated a 4 with pockets of 1s or 2s.
That's correct.
Does that also apply to countries that are a 3? Because I think what we're looking for, and maybe what you're saying, is that in a country that's a 3, we're looking for the kind of nuance that Mexico currently has, where we can make much more informed decisions about rerouting itineraries in a 3 that might have lots of 1s, you know, areas of mm-hmm. 1s and 2s.
It's never going to be an overall higher number with pockets of lower number. Does that make sense? It's only going to be an overall lower number with pockets of a higher number. Okay.
It's kind of like a weather forecast. It's always partly cloudy. It's not partly
right.
sunny.
Right.
Hi, Barbara Kakalidis again from Rosewood Hotels. So I've seen travel advisories directly affect my business. As soon as it comes out, mm-hmm. cancellations up the wazoo, and what are we doing in order to make that budget if we just lost all this? How are you getting this information out to the travel community? Because this just changed on January 10th, which I really didn't realize, but I want to make sure that my clients know about it, and how are you putting this message out there?
Well, I mean, for one, in forums like this, I know we're doing a lot of outreach. We've done outreach with our host governments. In Washington, they're doing a lot of outreach to get the word out. We always want to talk about, I mean, the website is not new, of course. Travel.state.gov has been around for a while. It's just on the 10th of January that we have put out all of our new travel advisories. So, like I said, in things like this, I know back in Washington, they're doing a whole round of various conferences and radio and, you know, just trying to get out the word as much as they can that it's new. Yes. Yeah.
Anyone else? Got a few more minutes. Last chance, going.
If you have any questions that you don't want to ask me in front of the group, I'll be here for a while, so you're welcome to find me afterwards as well.
Okay. So if you were not working for the State Department, you are not working for the State Department, and you want to go on vacation with your family, mm-hmm. would you go to Moscow? It's number three. You're not working for the State Department.
I mean, it would totally depend. You know, I mean, you like for any of these, I don't think you can lump all the threes together. You have to look, you know, at the right. information that's on there. And all this is advice. We're not telling you do not travel, except for the ones where we really say do not travel.
But
for the level three countries and the level twos, I mean, this is just advice. What you do with that advice okay. is up to you.
Okay,
and so it's all depending on how much risk you are willing to bear. Okay. Some people are more risk averse than others. So
that's good language for us all to use, that it is advice.
Yeah. That
but, it's scary. Advice. It's really scary when you open the page and you've got, you know, that color coding. I mean, it's mm-hmm. scary to people who are not so familiar with it.
Yep.
So, you know, we need to do training, too. Yeah.
Yeah, I just had an email the other day from someone who was freaked out to go to Level 1 Morocco because it was listed as a travel advisory. She didn't really understand that every country is listed now.
Right.
So that education is really, really important. I pointed out it's the same as if you went to Norway, and she was upset. But she went because her husband
I would never be upset to travel to Norway, but... Yeah, I realize that the word advisory is can kind of throw people off, but hopefully when they actually read the text, they will see when it says exercise normal precautions that will hopefully put their mind to rest a little bit more. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Well, I think that's it. As Marcy has said, she's going to be hanging out for a little bit. If you have any other questions, feel free to talk to her directly.
And my business cards are in the back, so if you have any questions you think of later, feel free to take my business card. It's on the back table.
But before we depart, actually, first round of applause. But just a quick reminder to please fill out the evaluation form and hand those to the room monitor on your way up.